Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Daniel Davis Deep Dive Roadshow Edition. I am obviously not in my studio in Washington, D.C. I am actually on a family vacation somewhere, but there's too many things happening in the world not to cover them for you. And that's what we're doing today. Lots of things have been happening in recent days. We've been covering the Russia-Ukraine war a little bit more because there have been some movements. Last week, we showed you how there was an issue where there was 1,500 Russian drones had fired into Ukraine over about a 24-hour period. We were expecting some kind of response. We got it this weekend where the Ukrainian side fired back in a pretty substantial measure as well into both the capital city of Moscow as well as into Crimea. The question is, where is this war going? Has there been a shift, or is Russia about to do something different? And we have back with us today on the show after a bit of a hiatus, we have Stanislav Krapivnik, sorry about that, former U.S. Army officer and military analyst. Currently coming to us from somewhere in Russia. Welcome back to the show.
Welcome. Oh, I'm in Moscow, so that's not too. All right. Well, Russia's a big place. It could be anywhere. Geolocating anybody in Moscow is pretty hard, too. it's a country on its own.
Well, listen, let's just kind of start off just off the top here about some of these issues that have been happening. Ukraine. Fired back after Russia got hit. This one big shot here from Moscow. There's a couple of them where there was some pretty big, at least images that show a lot of problems. And this is from the Kiev Post, obviously here. And then there, the Ukraine side, at least from their media, is claiming that over 48-hour blitz, they struck 48 Russian targets, but hit 186. Precision impacts, things that they hit. And of course, the Russian side is saying, well, we knocked all this stuff down with air defense, but some stuff got through. But that's a pretty big number of shots to get through and some pretty big ones, too. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, there's two issues here. Some drones get through because they have a wave of about 137 coming into Moscow from the northwest of Moscow. So they came around, they came down this way. We could hear them from where I was living. I've got friends who saw them flying over, getting shot down. The belts of anti-aircraft are pretty thick. Now, having said that, some of them did find targets, not the targets necessarily that the Ukrainians are claiming. But there's also the issue when they get shot down, things that go up have a tendency to come back down. So when you take out one of these airplane-sized drones, some of them get up to the size of small Cessnas. Fall somewhere, they're laden with explosives. Sometimes they'll explode in the air. Sometimes you have explosives laden all over a road or a field that has to be secured. And sometimes they land on buildings. And they also have, obviously, gasoline and their engines. So they cause secondary fires when they land on somebody's building. That was part of those damage reports that they claim. They actually just, drones were shot down and landed. There's some small factory building that they land on a roof of and caused a fire. There was a hit. You have Moscow's right here. You have a satellite city called Himki that comes into Moscow. Moscow is like an amoeba that's basically almost swallowed it. And further down the road, about 30 kilometers down, you have what's called Zelenograd, or Green City, which is actually part of Moscow. It's a Moscow satellite that was built back in the early 70s as a semi-closed city. In other words, they had they were developing a lot of electronics industry in that area, and they were they kept it under you had to have permits to go into that city or to go in and go out and to live. Now it's an open city. I mean, you can drive in and out anytime you want. The only closed cities in Russia right now, for the most part, are either military bases or on the border, certain security areas. Well, there were hits there, but again, those hits were into apartment buildings. In Himki, there was two women killed when their private house or single family house, we'll put it that way. In Russia, it's called private house, but it's a single family house, was hit by a drone. And yes, it was a two-story brick, real brick house, but there was a big enough explosion that took out the top story. I guess they were sleeping at the moment and they killed them both. There was a man that they were still trying to pull out from under the rubble. And there was another hit that killed two workers on a building that they were working on at night, construction workers. So that was most of the hits. There were friends of mine saw some of these hits coming in. Other friends of mine saw the drones being taken out in the air over fields, and friends that live at the edge of Moscow. In suburbia, what would be called in America, suburbia. Russia has just as much a suburbia now as the U.S. does. It's expanding rapidly. So that's one. There was a oil refinery, or it's an oil. Well, there's it, on the news. It's saying it's an oil storage facility, oil transport point that was hit on the edge of Moscow. Not the Moscow oil refinery, which is in the southeast of Moscow. Inside city limits, that big black smoke. What you normally see is they go after the oil storage facilities. Those are the big round drums that hold oil or petrol products. If it's a refinery, they make for a really nice picture like that for the Western press. Something big and smoking and dark, or big flames. But they're easily, it's a controllable flame, and they're easily replaced because they're not exactly very high technology. It's mostly just sheet metal on a frame with an insulator inside to keep the oil in, keep it from leaking out. So that's the problem with hitting a refinery. First of all, refineries are giant. I mean, if anybody lives in Texas, you know, I lived in Houston, Texas. If you go up to Beaumont and you hit one of those refineries, yeah. And it's like 10 miles long, and you're just going refinery, 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 refinery. And it's just hundreds of kilometers of pipe, and all of that pipe's under pressure with valves at different points, choke valves, and they're all computerized. And as soon as the pressure falls in any one part, the computer switches it off, and no more product is going down that valve, and the flame goes out. So it's easy enough to repair for the most part. Even the vessels that you are used in chemical reactions, while they're handmade, and some vessels, you know, I've worked on projects or a supply chain director of on a construction project for the Moscow refineries. In fact, we're expanding it to make E95 gasoline, 95 octane gasoline, which is the high end in Europe. We had 278 meter long vessels, but the vast majority of them are meter to maybe 3 meters long, so they can be replaced relatively quickly, maybe a week of work and get it in, get it replaced. So those things, they don't take any refinery down for a long time. There's lots of smoke, and there's lots of fire. Obviously, as my gunner told me once, while my tank was burning, and we were outside the tank, standing on top, and smoke starts shooting out from underneath my command seat. The turret was turned around. I was like, "Sir, there's smoke. Where there's smoke, there must be fire." Like, thank you. Yeah, and there's flames shooting up. Like, yep, there's fire. Get off the tank. Where there's smoke, there's fire. That gets put out. They just normally, I mean, the valves get switched off to these containers and just let them burn out. There's no point in trying to fight that fire. So it makes lots of pictures for Western media. Not much damage in the long run. That's the main attack.
So what are the, let's just look for a moment at the, what are the people in Russia thinking about? Because, I mean, the fact is, whether it's, even if it's not significant damage, it's definitely damage. And it's happening now in the capital city, which makes it seem like, okay, even Zelensky can reach into your capital city and you can slow it down, but you can't stop it. And these attacks have been increasing over the last several months. And as we're going to see here from a second from Zelensky himself, they seem to be getting more confident from this. Is there any change in the way the Russian people are viewing this? Like that, hey, the war's coming home, or we need to do something different. How is that dynamic?
Well, first of all, this isn't the first strike in or around Moscow. If you go outside of Moscow to the edges of Moscow, you'll see apartment buildings that have been hit. They cannot hit the hardened areas where you have the capital areas, government buildings, military sites. I mean, there's lots of small military bases on the outskirts of Moscow. They don't hit them because they can't hit them. So what they need to earn points. And I'm quite literally saying that. They need to earn points, so they need to kill somebody. What we have in Ukraine that nobody in the West is obviously talking about, but what is the reality is it's called the gamification of warfare. This is a subject I've been bringing up recently because nobody in the West talks about this for obvious reasons, because it shows this is a model that was developed by NATO and given to Ukraine. And it just shows the inhumanity, the total inhumanity that NATO has unfortunately reached. What gamification means is they earn points per target destroyed, be it a top points obviously goes for any heavy equipment that they can find, secondary for military personnel, trinary for civilian equipment, then civilian cars. Then, I mean, even if it's a baby in a pram, they will hit that baby in a pram because they get points for it. And then they turn around, they get these points, and they turn around at the end of the month, they spend them, and they get new equipment, swag, better rations, and or better pay increases, what have you. They get bonuses. So their incentive, they've been incentivized to kill something. And they can't kill military. They'll go after whatever civilian they can. And on the average, in the border areas to the conflict, ranging from Bryansk all the way down to Khersonov, that big circle, there's about 5 to 10 civilians killed every single day. They will drop grenades or they'll do kamikaze attacks on civilian cars or gas stations, whatever they can. That's how they earn points. This is, by the way, while Ukrainian drone operators never seem to become prisoners of war. When the Russian military moves through in any area, you can make your own conclusion off of that. But it's a gamification of war. So even when they're coming in and if they can't hit hardened targets, they will go for an apartment building. Some videos have come out. We've had friends and friends of parts of my family that took videos and they were out in the balconies because there's a lot of blasts. I mean, it was going on for about 2 hours. A lot of people woke up. It's bright daylight already. It's almost summertime. So sun comes up at about 3:30 in the morning, 4 in the morning. It's bright daylight by that point. And people are just taking videos of these drones. There was, I think, about 8 or 9 strikes. So about 9 drones out of 127 got through. Just basically they overload the system. They overload the anti-aircraft system. But the problem here is, you know, with these strategic drones, I mean, there's several initiatives. One initiative that's proposed, I think, is going to go forward, and it's been in public news, so I'm not telling any secrets, is to set up lines of radar stations. Basically, Russia's huge. I mean, it's the biggest country in the world. You can always find some corridor on when you're doing a map of the earth to get through. So what the proposal is to set up radar towers every 20 kilometers. So you have a weak off-the-shelf radar unit that goes about 10 kilometers out, and then the next one goes 10 kilometers out. And you just form a chain at a relatively inexpensive rate across Russia, and you know, just rows. And their job is to give signals that something's coming in. So you get early warning systems. So there's that initiative that probably is going to go forward. It's been discussed. It's been in the news, too. It's been discussed. Obviously, the anti-aircraft systems are being constantly added to. It's in mass production. It's not like the Patriot systems where they build them by hand. There's mass manufacturing conveyor lines to pump these missiles out to come. And again, of course, these drones are cheaper than the missiles, but it's not like, the U.S. Patriot system at $5 million a pop trying to take out a $50,000 drone from the Iranians. It's much closer cost difference, cost gap. But that's one of them. But through the people, to answer your question, the people are angry. Now, they're not angry. Well, they are angry. There's more anger at the government, but not the way the West wants it. The West imagines, Putin is their problem. Get rid of Putin and you're going to get some Yeltsin in and it'll be happy times, 90s again. We'll get to rape, murder, and pillage Russia as we want. And we're going to all feast off the big whale for the next 200 years. The people that are going to take over are going to be nationalists. And Putin has been the one that's keeping a large war from happening, quite simply. The anger in the population, as one person said it, Ukrainians are, in our view anyways, Ukrainians are Russians that have had a lot of brainwashing. But as one person said it very well, Ukrainians have accomplished something that nobody's accomplished in Russia since 1941. They taught Russians how to hate again. Russians don't tend to hate other nations. But now the hatred, visceral hatred, is starting to grow. And there's demands that why is Kyiv still standing? Why hasn't it been leveled like Gaza? It could be flooded easily. In fact, one of Kiev's, there was a monk back in about the 1500s who had a prophecy that when Kiev goes away from God, Kyiv will be flooded in a Titanic flood. Well, there's a big dam not far away that could actually do that. So you may have prophecy coming through in that. But the point is, yes.
So here's the question. If that's already a growing anger, how is that being fed, or what is it manifesting into? When you have, on top of these increasing drone strikes, even if they're strategically ineffective, they still do have the images. You still do get the game points, as you call them. People do see them, and it's making them angry. And then on top of that, you have, I think it was yesterday, Volodymyr Zelensky saying this.
Сьогодні дуже масштабно сили оборони України, наша служба безпеки України, наша розвідка відпрацювали по московському регіону. Хороша хвиля наших діпстрайків, забезпечуємо Україні цю можливість. Дистанція до цілей цього разу більш ніж 500 кілометрів. Це вагомо ще й тому, що московський регіон найбільш насичений російськими засобами ППО. Вони свій район влади бережуть найбільше, але українські далекобійні кроки вже це долають. Як я вчора і казав, росіянам треба думати про свої НПЗ, про свої нафтові об'єкти, про свої підприємства, а не про те, як зламати життя інших народів в Україні, чи в Молдові, чи в будь-якій іншій країні-сусідці. Також наші сили оборони відпрацювали за цю добу по об'єктах на тимчасово окупованій території, зокрема в Криму. І ця наша далекобійність – це те, що значно змінює ситуацію і загалом сприйняття російської війни в світі.
So now he's got a couple of audiences there, actually three as I see it. Number one, to his audience to say, hey, we're doing something. We're taking the fight to them. So keep the faith going. Keep on fighting here because we're changing now. We're turning the dynamic around. That's a phrase I keep hearing recently. Then the other one is the Western audience to say, hey, we are succeeding, but I need more of this. Keep feeding the machine here. And then I think that arrogantly, this is the presumption on my part, that he may be trying to say to the Russian people, you know, you think you're safe, but you're not. We're coming after you, and we're going to come after your oil infrastructure, so you better be careful, kind of as a warning to them, et cetera. But I think we can assume that on the Russian side, he's just going to make more anger and more resistance, not anything else. But I think he could also, you could argue that he would be successful at his audience and the Western audience. What impact is that going to have in the war, do you think?
Danny, I think you're absolutely right. That's exactly what he's saying on the third part, and on the first and the second part, too. The effect, you know, for a person who Russian is his native language, by the way, he's also a Russian citizen. I don't believe he ever gave up his Russian citizenship. He had dual citizenship. So he's also a traitor at this point, interestingly enough. For a person that grew up around Russians, he seems to really not understand Russians in the least. Starting in 2022, the Ukrainians, and this has been given by testimony from captured Azov members from Mariupol, were given the order to massacre any Russian prisoners, cut them up into pieces, make signs out of bodies, and mutilate the bodies, and videotape that to break Russian morale. Well, there was nothing better to push Russian morale forward than that. That has the exact opposite effect. Every time they strike into Russia, the Russian enlistment numbers go up. Kursk saw huge enlistment numbers at that point. People were being turned away because they just couldn't process that many people, the volunteers coming in. So this is actually having just the opposite effect, which is amazing that they continue doing it because it's kind of stupid. They're not making any major strikes, but they're doing a lot to really piss the population off. And the question is, you know, there's two things here. Two effects that the Iran war has had, by the way, on Russia, and it's played a lot toward pressure toward the government. Because the question is, first of all, look, the Israelis want to kill somebody. The Israelis just go and kill their leaders. Why aren't we doing the exact same thing to everything that runs Ukraine? And in this case, you know, some arguments will say, well, you know, they'll just be the next one up. But I don't believe that. In a second, I'll tell you why. When you're fighting Iran, when you're fighting Russia, when you're fighting China, any of these countries that are civilization states, the people that believe in that civilization state, you kill one, the next guy steps up, and then the next guy steps up. When you have Russian officers going into basically unwinnable situations, going, за Господа и за Родину, for Christ and for the motherland and forward they go. It's hard to fight these types of people because they're willing to be martyred for God and for the motherland. An Orthodoxy is built on martyrdom just as well as Shia Islam is, Orthodox Christianity. When you're fighting, why did Saddam fall? Because it was a very thin layer. There was no ideology. So when the U.S. kills Khomeini, the next Khomeini, in this case, steps up. And you kill him, there will be another one. And there'll be another one and another one and another one because there's a civilization state that believes in its civilization.
But I want to really zero in on mm-hmm. what may happen next on the Russian side, especially. This morning in Ukrainian news, Zelensky just says, hey, there has been a shift in balance on the battlefield, and we're going to keep doing this. We're going to keep moving further and further. That is setting off some alarm bells in the folks who are very much pro-Russian, because not out of fear that he's going to succeed, but out of anger that it keeps happening. And you mentioned a minute ago, some have suggested there's anger at Putin for not, you know, doing more, not being more aggressive, et cetera. Well, you've had a couple of figures, Sladkov and Karaganov, have said, you know what, we need to put it into this. We need to start striking conventional targets inside of Western Europe, where these facilities are made that allow these kinds of strikes to come in, et cetera. We had Ambassador Polyansky from the OSCE, Russia's ambassador to the OSCE last week. And he, as much as you can as a diplomat, almost came out and said, yeah, I think it's probably too late to avoid that because the other side is continuing to move further. And he all but said, yeah, I think that there's a real chance of that. And it may already be too late, was the phrase that he said. In some of your and our conversations, you said it might not be where the decision has been made, but there are some things that concern you. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I don't know if the decision has finally firmly been made. You know, I was talking to some of my sources who are very they're not necessarily in the first ranks or assistants or first ranks in Kremlin, but they're in the Kremlin itself. And they were saying, you know, Medvedev, by the way, so a lot of people look at Medvedev because he was pretty liberal when he was president. So he suddenly become very conservative and outspoken. He said, no, he's changed. He's leading the fraction that wants the deep strikes. And he's quite changed on that. He had an epiphany. But the problem here is, Danny, we've reached a point where it's either, and I don't think the Europeans understand, I don't think the people in power in Europe have the IQ to understand what they're about to face. The Russian state now has the option of going into a conventional war with Europe or waiting a little while and going into a nuclear war with Europe and the U.S. while we're at it. So I think for the U.S. anyways, a conventional war would be much better, especially the U.S. stays out of it. Because what's happening right now, and I'll explain very, very easily, simply, these deep strike drones, the aim of the Europeans is to start mass producing, and they're doing it, mass producing these deep strike drones to overpower the Russian anti-aircraft system. So far, the Russian aircraft systems, they are handling everything. The hardened targets aren't being hit, and the softer targets are still being, even though they get hit on and off, it's not either as much damage or they're being hardened, in the process of being hardened. But the point is you can, of course, outproduce the Russian side if everybody starts concentrating on these drones. And what we've seen when that happens is, what's the next real targets? The next real targets are Russian early warning radar systems. We've seen attacks on, though they're one-off attacks, but they won't stay one-off attacks, on Russian strategic bombers. And maybe they'll even go after Russian nuclear submarines in port. Well, what you have, except for the U.S. and Israel, well, the Israel official doesn't have nuclear weapons, of course, no other nation has a first strike doctrine. They all have a second strike doctrine, including Russia. But the problem is, if the U.S. has a first strike doctrine and Russia is now blind, the logic of nuclear weapons is, since the enemy has a first strike doctrine, now, no matter what kind of relationship you may or may not have between Putin and Trump, if the opponent there has a first strike doctrine and you're now blind and you'll only find out minutes before the strike, the obvious logic is use it or lose it and use everything, which would mean burn Europe and burn everything north of the Rio Grande to a cinder. Of course, Russia would get hit too, but then it would be an equal footing. versus waiting to get struck by a nuclear salvo from the U.S. or plus France and possibly England, and then not being able to strike back. So that's where we're heading. So the decision point is, do we strike and wipe out these manufacturing facilities, which the Russian government can and knows where they're at. Russia can easily reach any target from Ireland to the Russian border. Or do we wait till we're looking at a nuclear war? Now, will Europe go into conventional war? Maybe. But most Russians have, throughout much of the civilian population, have gone, well, if it's war, it's war. Fine. You can't scare Russians with war. We've been getting invaded by the Europeans since 1012 AD. It's been 1,000 years of nonstop invasion. So while most Russians don't want war, you really can't scare Russians with war. Well, the majority of Russians will say that. So it's that point, you know, whether or not the European leadership has the mental capacity to understand. I think the American leadership quite well understands this.
Whether they understand, I don't know that it's a problem of understanding as it is a problem of believing that the Russians won't, because they saw all these red lines, red lines that were crossed throughout the first 4 years. Russia never did anything beyond the boundaries of Ukraine. And now then, I can just tell you, I can see from the statements, these leaders across the board in Europe as a whole don't believe that Russia ever will.
They will.
Being that the West will continue to do these things and accelerate them. The question is, will Russia actually do anything about it?
It will. One way or the other, it will. There's no doubt about this. And when you heard, you know, the first sign that should have spooked them hard enough is when the military came out and said, you touch the parades, we exterminate central Kyiv. And Russia could do it with ease. Russian drones fly over, watch the elites getting in and out of their cars and out of their apartments and offices. There's nothing that will stop a rain of destruction that equals something around Gaza on that level in the center of Kyiv. The only thing that's stopping it is the government. It has not made that decision. But when the military came out, which is for Russians, for the military to say something like that, you know, things have gotten to a degree where, you know, I think this is why Trump went very, very forcefully. We'll just say it that way. Went very forcefully to Zelensky to stop him from doing it. Believe you me, myself included, most people were hoping they would do something to finally get it going. This is the sentiment in Russia. You know, I have my children here that get threatened. I almost had one of my children. She barely missed the terror attack on the concert in Krakow City. And another friend, his 15-year-old daughter was working that concert. The only reason she was alive is because somebody didn't show up on the third floor, and she went. She was sent from reception to the third floor to seat people. Otherwise, she would have been killed. I mean, when you see that, the anger is past palatable. And the anger, you know, the anger leads to action. Sooner or later, the government has to comply. Otherwise, it loses validity in the eyes of people. So at this point, the military, I know the military. I speak to these people, and not just senior officers or junior officers, but also to people on the line. I've been down 14 times. I'll be heading down soon again. I just got back 2 weeks ago. Everybody wants the war to end, but they don't want the war to end. The biggest fear is some kind of deal. They want capitulation. They want the victory parade in Kyiv. That's what the people on the front lines want. They've invested too much time and too many lives not to get that. So that's the reality of it. The military wants forward. It's advancing. It's not advancing as fast as it'd like, but it's advancing on all fronts. Even the Zaporozhye front, where they've been throwing everything they've had, it's all been stopped. The latest counter assault offensives in the western Zaporozhye have been stopped and are now starting to roll back. Ukrainians have a tendency of breaking through and grabbing land on a counter offensive, but they have no staying power because they use it all up to break through. When you're losing any one small assault, up to 600 dead, dozens of vehicles destroyed, even if you grab that small village, there's so few people left. And they can't get more people in without doing a mass movement because of drones. You don't have the staying power afterwards. Plus, in the end of the day, Ukrainians, the main things that that wipe out the Ukrainian army are not drones, it's artillery. From the Ukrainian side, it's drones versus the Russian army, because they don't have the artillery, and most of their line infantry are press gang people that don't have combat experience, that don't have combat training, and they're not very interested in staying around. So when the Russian infantry gets close, they usually tend to run now. But the drones are what slow Russian troops down. But on the other side, it's still artillery, ever heavier artillery. It's just laying waste to a whole section of the front.
So the question is, because if we were just talking about this incremental thing that Russia's been doing since 2023, a year from now, we'll just be a few kilometers more forward, but this will keep going on. So the real operative question is, what do you think? Will Russia eventually, and I'm talking maybe even in the near term, take action, or do you think Putin is just going to say, no, I'm going to be content, even if this takes another 2 or 3 years, to keep this dragging out phase?
Well, it won't be a few kilometers. There's a very good chance very soon northeastern portion of Kharkov Oblast will fall. This is a very large area. Kupinsk was the gateway to it. So now they're in the process of reorganization. There's no lines of defense west of Kupinsk all the way to the water reserves that are just east of Kharkov. And then from the north, Russia's cut off the lines because they're advancing across the border. That's a good chunk. Sumy will be under siege probably within the next month. Russian forces in the north are about 8-9 kilometers from Sumy, from the edge of the city. It's a light walk half a day walk. So there's areas like that that there's a steady advance and breakthrough. But overall, you know, the question again, Iran and the effect Iran had on U.S. military bases. Look, you know, Iran, let's be honest, Iran destroyed 13 American bases. Fifth Fleet Forward is now going to be located in Israel. They're not coming back to Qatar. There's nothing there left. Everything, I've seen videos of people that were taken from these bases. It's destroyed. Everything's very heavily damaged. And was there a nuclear exchange? No, there was no nuclear exchange. The U.S. did not drop nuclear weapons on Tehran. I'm not saying the Israelis might not do it, but the U.S. didn't do it, and it's not going to do it. It's the same thing. And then the question becomes, well, why aren't we doing this to Estonia? That's the drones fly through, or lifting the drones off Estonia. Why aren't we doing it in Poland, where the base is the transfer point for equipment and for men into Ukraine? Why aren't we doing this across the board? We could do this to NATO. They're not going to go to nuclear war, and we'll win. And that's the pressure on the government right now. Whether or not the decision has been made, I don't know. It's hard to say because different signals going at one point, yes, at one point, no, at one point, let's talk again. But I think the overall sentiment in the public is escalation. It's to escalate and escalate hard. When you hear these other voices like Kurganov saying what he's saying, yes, I don't believe, you know, you should go to nuclear weapons. Because that's a genie that's very hard to control once it gets out. If it's impossible to control, and once both sides have nuclear weapons, or all sides in this case may have nuclear weapons, this becomes a very difficult thing to stop. But on a conventional side, Russia doesn't need nuclear weapons. With weapon systems like Oreshniks, with kinetic energy weapons, with glide vehicles carrying hypersonic kinetic energy weapons, you don't need the nuclear weapons to destroy the bunker systems, to destroy the command posts, no matter how deep they get. So that changes the logic very, very quickly for very targeted strike infrastructure. That's where we're at right now.
You know, Stas, it seems to me, this is just my sensing of it. Obviously, I'm not in Moscow. I don't have any connections there. But it just feels to me like it's inevitable. Like we're already past the Rubicon, and at some point that pressure is going to be enough. They're going to take action. And I just can't help but remember – If back in April of 2022, we had taken that deal to get the war off the table in the second month, how many people would have stayed alive and what Ukraine would look like today after years of recovery and rebuilding and whatever, as opposed to what it's going to look like at the end if this happens? That's going to be something that people are going to have to answer for.
I'll take it one step further. If Yanukovych had a backbone, he doesn't. He said, oh, I didn't want to spill Christian blood. That's why he didn't take out the demonstrators. He had a prime opportunity to surround Maidan and just wipe out the demonstrators, which, by the way, what happened in Uzbekistan when the color revolution was tried there. the government wiped them out, quite literally surrounded the areas and shot everything. And Uzbekistan has a good economy and is growing. Yanukovych could have done the same thing, and millions of people's lives would have been spared. He didn't. He said, "Oh, I couldn't." He set his police up without weapons, just to stand there as human shields while Molotov cocktails were being thrown at him, while snipers were shooting at him, and he betrayed his own state. Yanukovych being a coward. You know, if you're going to go into federal level politics and you're afraid to spill human blood, don't go into federal level politics. It's not worth it. Because if you're not ready to defend your state with violence, don't go. Because the violence that gets unleashed afterwards is going to be 10 times worse. For the price of a couple thousand radicals in Maidan in 2013, he could have saved millions of people's lives and may have saved hundreds of millions of people's lives, depending which way this all goes. Because he was a coward and wouldn't make that decision. Now we are where we're at.
Yeah, well, we can't go back and undo that stuff in the past, but we can sure do whatever we can to try to keep it from going any further here. But we'll have to wait and see what the decision makers say. instead of guys like you and me who try to analyze this from where it's at. But really appreciate you bringing some light onto the situation that we just otherwise aren't going to see in the West, and we really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. And always hoping for, you know, rainbows and butterflies. Unfortunately, they seem to get shot these days. But, you know, we keep hoping for them that things can go back.
There's always a hope.
Something abnormal.
All right. Thank you very much. And we will look forward to seeing you on the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep.